All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Today on the show, I'll be talking to Tony Shalhoub in a bit. It was a nice chat. He's a great guy, and I was excited to talk to him. He's very good in Mrs. Maisel, but he's also been great in everything he's ever done. I think my first experience with Tony was probably in Barton Fink, which he was great in Barton Fink. But I got to tell you what's going on, because this is audio. Some of you know me very well from listening to me, and I don't want to sound heavy-hearted or fucked up to you in a way where you're like, what's up? But I am heavy-hearted today, and I know it's Monday, and I don't want to, bum anybody out. But, things happen. Obviously, the world is out of our control, sure. There's horror stories every day all around us. But my little kitten, Buster Kitten, is sick, and he's very sick. And he's in the hospital. Now, I don't know. When this stuff happens, I always think about other people with bigger problems, with real illness and family members and themselves, a tragedy, whatever. But this is my life, and this kitten, I've gotten to love this kitten, and he's in the hospital. He's sick, and I don't know what the fuck is wrong with him, but I do know exactly what's wrong with him. I don't know really how it happened. A few days ago, he was throwing up, and he threw up a few times during the day, and he wasn't eating. But these are cats. I've been dealing with cats for years, and it happens sometimes. And I didn't know whether I should take him in. I didn't take him in, and then that night I got home. His energy was okay, but he still was not eating, and I loaded him up. I called the emergency vet in Eagle Rock, and I was like, should I bring him in? And of course, they're like, yeah, bring him in. And then I looked at him and I said, I think I'm gonna just do it in the morning. And because he'd had some sort of stomach thing before. And well, the next morning, I got up early, and So I brought him into my vet, and there's a new vet there, thank God. And, he was really good, this guy, Dr. Ram. I told him about the stomach thing. He looked at the past files, and then he did blood tests. And, he comes out, he says, look, this cat, is in kidney failure right now. And I'm like, what the fuck? This is a 2.5-year-old cat. This is a, little black cat. And I'm like, what do we do? And, he said, well, it's Friday. He's going to need 24-hour care. We got to put him on fluids and antibiotics. We don't know what it is. And then I started thinking, like, did he eat some of this poison shit? And then I started thinking, like, wait a minute, he was kind of licking his dick the other day, last week on last Sunday. And I think there might have been bloody pee in the box, but sometimes Fonda does that. I didn't know if it was blood. I didn't know if it was shit. I don't know, man. I got three cats over here, and I'm not trying to let myself off the hook. The best apparently that can happen is that it's an actual infection and it's not toxic, and that hopefully, I don't know. I'm waiting to hear today. So I took him to another vet that has 24-hour care, and we got him, on it, and he's been over there. And I don't have children, I don't have a lot of debt. I don't live a big life, and I've been critical in my life about people who spend what seems like a lot of money on cats. But look, I'm 55. I'm going to spend a little money to see if I can save this guy, So I'm waiting to hear, I just it's weird what you go through when you're a cat owner or a pet owner, like especially one with no kids and not a ton of successful relationships behind you. We get very emotionally invested, in these animals. And I try to think about that, because people are like, they're like your kids. Well, they're not really like kids. They're very different than kids, obviously. He's sick, Buster is, he's in intensive care, and I'm not sitting here thinking I had a whole future planned out for that cat. I wanted to get him into a good kindergarten so he could go to a good elementary school or whatever, and I wanted to, him to win track meets and stuff. I had none of those expectations, but that doesn't make it any less upsetting. It does in a sense, because there are plenty of cats out there and you build a relationship with these things. But what I was thinking about this morning is that, some of us who own animals, that's what we can handle emotionally. That's not sad. It's not weird. Sometimes maybe it's just a reflection of what we know about ourselves. Some of us are not built for the child rearing in the long haul. Maybe we could adapt to it, but there's something about, having a pet where it, the emotional connection is manageable. It's something we can handle. It's relatively consistent and it can last a long time, and it's deep and it's honest, and it doesn't change a whole lot. And if you're lucky, you get to grow old with your stupid animals. I got Monkey and LaFonda in there, and those are the longest relationships I've had. It's been 15 years, and they've changed, but it's just consistency, and you can take care of them. And the thing about cats more than dogs is that it's not always perfect, because you realize, they don't really need you that much in some ways. They're not loyal. So you have an understanding, an emotional understanding. And I was building one with Buster, and, he was a very unique cat. Is. I hope. I'm waiting to hear. And, he fetches, he's unique looking, he's kind of peculiar and smart, and, he's an energetic guy. He is. We went over and visited him yesterday, and then I'm like, am I that guy? But so, yeah, I am that guy. I'm going to go visit my fucking cat at the hospital to see how he's doing. So, I don't know. Hoping for the best. I'm hoping for the best. I'll know today. And this is just, this is my life. And it's like, it's different, but it's weird. That moment that I had that sense that, this is why we have cats. Because, it's what we can handle. In that way. So, but I wasn't going to read this email because I don't know really what it says about me or what it is really, but it has some bearing on what's happening right now. How do I transition to an ad? Shit. Maybe I should read the email after and pull it together a little here. And I'll tell you, a lot of you people don't even know. It's okay, but someone came up to me last night and he's like, who's Boomer? If you listen all the way to the end of this show and you hear me say Boomer lives, people are like, some people come up to me and go, how's Boomer doing? And it's like, Boomer's not around. What does that mean? And I realized that we've been doing this so long, over almost 1,000 episodes, that some people don't know, what Boomer lives means. And many of you who have been with me the whole time have been through a lot of stuff with these cats and other cats. When I lived at the old house, it was a little more rural, and there was a lot of cats coming and going. And, I had deaf black cat who, for years, that deaf, weird, feral cat that I had, I used to feed. And he was, he ended violently, with another animal. He was killed by a coyote, but it was a decade of relationship with this cat that I couldn't even touch. And then there was a big head, is still around out there. He started coming around. And then there was Scaredy Cat, who, got hit by a car eventually, another feral. And then Scaredy 2 was around. And then there was one that came around the house back at the old house from, a decade ago, and then showed up 8 years later just to die under my house. And then there was another one that used to hang out on my porch, a wild cat that was clearly ill that I had to put down. And all through this, I had Monkey and LaFonda. And then earlier, when I was with my second wife, Mishina, she had Moxie, who was a great cat, fat little cat that used to fetch things. And, in my sadness and anger during the divorce, I made her take Moxie away, which was probably a mistake. I probably could have used Moxie. But Boomer, for a little backstory, and this is a transition, Boomer was a cat When I moved to when I moved from New York to Los Angeles in 2002, I went to a shelter with Mishnah, and I looked around at all these old cats. Some it looked like people had just left in places, but there was this one skittish, fucked up, crazy ginger cat, and I'm like, "That's my guy, the nut." Couldn't even get him in a cage. I now realize he was a feral cat that someone brought in because of my other cats were feral, but Boomer, eventually somewhat got socialized and. He was with me for almost a decade. We moved him to the other house. He used to pee on everything, and then he was outside. So for years, Boomer sort of held up the porch and was out there with the wild things, and he was a very unique cat. He had a very sweet voice, and I kind of regret having put him outside, but he just peed on everything. He peed where we ate, where we, my shoes, everywhere. So he lived outside, and he lived out there for years, and at some point he disappeared, and I don't know what happened to him. Sometimes I think that's harder. Sometimes it's better. I just assume that maybe he went on to a better life. And that's where Boomer Lives comes from. I guess he disappeared probably 8 years ago. But that's where that comes from. That's a short history of me and the cats. It is what it is. And, this is life. So I didn't know if I was going to read this letter, but I will because it's strange for me. Sometimes being a public personality, because I'm not a huge celebrity or anything, but I am a public personality, and people who know me or they now know my work from a lot of different areas with acting or whatnot, and I don't really know what they're recognizing me from or whatever. But I've always tried to be gracious, but it is sort of interesting the world we live in that we're all pretty accessible, and things get through to us. I didn't mean for this to have this impact, but when I read this, when it came in, it was the first thing that sort of connected me with how I was feeling, because you get, when you have a sick, anything and you're trying to take care of it and you're in that panic of trying to save something or help something or make it okay. You're not thinking about really yourself. You're not thinking about how you're being seen or others or anything. So I got this email and it really connected me with what I was feeling because I stuff things down. I really try to. If I'm going to cry, I'm going to do it alone. And that sometimes is here on this microphone. I'm alone right now, believe it or not. I am. So the email, lessons learned at the vet. Hi, Mark. I've been listening since 2010, not in a dramatic 180 kind of way, of course. Radio fandom runs in my family. My dad had Gene Shepherd, and I get a lot out of your show. It's a beacon in the dark. Last night, I was with my daughter at the vet with a little dog we'd adopted from a shelter the day before. That very sweet dog surprised us all and turned out to be very sick. While we were waiting in the lobby to talk with the vet, I knew the dog wasn't going to make it. Anyway, that's when you walked in. You were with your lady, I guess, who seemed real cool. I could tell you were both totally focused on care for your cat, and I could tell it was a tough night for you, too. I'm in show business. You're one of my heroes, but I'm not an approacher, so I felt a little sheepish just sitting there witnessing the scene, but what I saw was a big deal. I struggle with the business. I struggle with illusions and mistakes. Honesty, and even booze. And you've narrated those struggles for me, given them context and turned them into gold. I put you on a pedestal for that. If you don't have it all figured out, at least you've reached a level of self-awareness that defines your ultra-successful art. I also love to see you on the screen because I identify with you. Just a matter of shared traits. There are lots of us. You are a massive personality. That night at the vet, I saw something different. I saw a man who cared about his pet. Someone expressing unconditional love. I saw someone coping with the bullshit of medical forms and responsibilities, waiting in waiting rooms, just hoping your little buddy wasn't suffering. I think it's a beautiful thing you were doing, just totally human. And it helped me deal with the loss we suffered last night when we knew that our little cricket's short life was over. I want to say thank you for all that you do, for caring about your cat and everyone else you've spoken to in that intimate space between our ears where your show is piped right in. You've made us all feel better, and that's all the more profound, knowing you are a real goddamn human being. Thanks, man, 1,000 times for being you, Ivan. Well, I do my best, buddy, and I'm sorry for your loss, for your new little friend, and you know, I gotta tell you, man, this email really kind of, I guess it sometimes it takes, it's weird, you know, you have this, you know, an outsider view, and you know, I'm just caught up in it, but it, you know, I think I'm feeling more feelings for what you're going through, actually, but it's good, it's good, fuck. I don't know. Fuck. Okay. Tony Shalhoub. Great guy. And the second season of Marvelous Miss Maisel is now streaming on Amazon Prime. And, you know, it was just a pleasure talking to him. This is me and Tony. So wait, so you're going to do a season 3?
Starting in March.
In March.
But I've been down since mid-September.
Right. Yeah, I watched the whole first season. I've watched like 6 of the new ones.
So you've seen the Catskills stuff?
Yes.
And all that.
Yeah, yeah.
That was fun.
No, I'm surprised I like it. Because yeah. It's a very specific, Miss Maisel is a very specific type of show, but it's so specific and it's so... They're so attentive to detail, and there's such a rhythm to the writing, and it's like, and I'm a comic, so yeah. I get very moved by the whole thing. It works for me.
Oh, good.
I really like it, and I like it. Your character really has a lot to do this season.
I mean, they really boosted my part.
It's weird because how are you finding people responding to the show in general?
Well, the show's blowing up. It's crazy.
I mean,
we were in. We did a whole press junket prior to the premiere in early December in New York.
Yeah.
Right after that and before the premiere hit, we went to Milan.
Yeah.
And we did another press junket for all of the European press and outlets. And when we were there, then it really started to become obvious that it was catching fire, you know, around the world.
Globally.
Crazy.
Yeah.
And we actually had people interviewing us, you know, the Italian press, of course, was there. People from Germany, Spain, France.
Yeah.
And we were on doing phoners with people in India. And
no kidding.
Thinking, how is this working in India? They seem to really have embraced the show. They dropped these episodes, you know, all at the same time everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Our premiere date was December 5th, I think. And, you know, in the old days when I did network and even cable, you know, you did a season and that aired. And then 2 years later or something, that season would air in
elsewhere,
Europe.
Right.
And it would go to Far East.
It'd get bought and syndicated.
Whatever. And Russia. But, you know, they were always, I would get letters and things. They were always 2 or 3 years behind us.
Right, right.
And now it's... Whew, everything just goes everywhere at the same moment.
Well, the reason I say I'm surprised I like the show because I don't watch a lot of things, and it's such a
I don't either.
It's such a specific sort of world, and the device of it to sort of put a feminist voice, you know, in that period, you know, which I think is the device of it as a comic, because I know that comics of that ilk were not women then. Right. And they are now.
Yeah.
And then to sort of set this in, and it's just the writing is so tight.
Well, I think that's the thing about it, too, is that it takes place in the late 50s.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a need for us to escape, you know, for viewers to escape the present day madness. And but at the same time, it's not just a nostalgia piece. It has a modern
right,
you know, sensibility.
Right,
it sort of bridges the two periods. I think, you know, in a smart way.
Yeah, and also like, and that's the thing. It's like you're not watching. It is. It's nostalgia in one way, but the sort of attention to detail of the period, you know, really goes a long way. I mean, it just seems like, you know, every frame, mm-hmm. including the dialogue and the look and the pace and the costumes and everything else, they're like jewel boxes. I mean, they're meticulous in terms of their attention to detail.
And it's heightened somewhat.
You know, it's very heightened.
We're not trying to paint an absolutely authentic reproduction of that period. It's more almost, people have referred to it kind of more like a musical in a way. It's kind of bright and colorful and energy, and there is a lot of music just inherent in it, and it's written in a kind of rhythm.
Yeah,
it has that heightened.
Right, you're not sitting there going like, it wasn't really like this.
Yeah,
it's
comedy and
right.
You know.
And it's not like, you know, I mean, you've done three camera stuff. It's not a joke to joke thing, really.
No.
So like, it's one of these hybrids where you realize that this is not supposed to be realism.
Right.
But, and you realize it's heightened, but because of the shininess of it and the pace of it and also the emotional range of the thing.
Right. The stakes are very high.
It is like a musical.
It's not a sitcom.
No. And, it is like a musical a little bit.
It is, yeah. I think that's, there's choreographed, what almost, they're not actual dance numbers, but they feel like.
Oh, were people coming and going?
Moving through rooms and turning and spinning and those are, master shots, long takes.
Yeah.
Without a lot of cuts. And those are rehearsed like a play. I mean, they really have to be precise with the Steadicam and all of the background.
And that's that's a very
deliberate. Very,
yeah. But deliberate. But as an actor, I mean, that's one of those. It's like a play. It's like doing a musical. That the requirement isn't just like hit your mark, do your line.
No. That's right.
You've got a dance number to do in a way. Like that scene, just even in that bit where. You guys are rearranging the furniture in the Catskills cabin. The thing's coming out, things going in. There's a, and that's just a lead into the episode.
Yeah, the camera lays back and stays in that wide master.
Right, but there's all that stuff.
It goes on for 4 minutes. It's fantastic.
Does it remind you of doing, you've done musicals.
Well, I did one musical this past year, The Band's Visit, which is not a conventional musical.
Oh, you didn't, like, so when you were starting out, you didn't do any?
Yeah, I mean, when I was in school and, in theater, I did one or two, but I was not a musical guy.
Yeah.
But it, this does have a, this has, does have a feel like we're doing a play every week.
I bet. Yeah. I bet it does. And how much, I'm curious about this because, like, I'm on a show.
Yeah, it's a great
simultaneous
show.
To yours. Thank you. But I'm just curious in terms of her writing, like, Amy Sherman Palladino. Is it Amy Sherman?
Amy Sherman,
yeah. Her dad was a comic, right?
He was.
Don Sherman.
Don Sherman. Yeah. He was, you can actually see him on YouTube. He's really funny. He was a guy who, what I've seen of him, he was on, like, Cruise Ship.
That kind of guy.
But he was a Borscht Belt guy.
Sure.
He was coming up with, Jack Carter and all those guys.
Yeah, Freddie Roman and Jan Murray.
They were all Jan Murray. Mm-hmm. All those guys, when I was a kid, we used to see on Ed Sullivan. And
sure.
And he was rising, and he just didn't quite, Don Sherman didn't quite break through like those other guys did, but he was... You can watch him, and he's really funny.
There's a lot of those guys, man. There's a lot of those...
in that world.
Yeah. Oh, really? So she really knows it.
Well, that's what she's kind of writing about. And her mother was a, and still is actually, so still kicking, a kind of cabaret singer, dancer.
Oh, really?
She's amazing. She's in her 80s.
She's still doing it? Yes. So my question is, how much writing is still going on when you shoot? Like, how many times do you read through it?
We do a table read for each episode.
Yeah.
There's like 100 people in the room,
Really?
Amazon. Oh, yeah. All the designers are Amazon people.
No kidding.
It's a big room. In Brooklyn, in New York. And, but that's it. We read it. We read it once.
Yeah.
There's some changes. Some changes are made.
Yeah.
Not a lot. Doesn't change drastically.
Uh-huh.
And then we start, there's whatever location scouts they have to do. And then we just hit the ground running. And we do them in 10 days.
10 days each episode.
Yeah. But they're full hour. There's no commercials or anything. So, it's a full 60 minutes of craziness.
And everything's on location?
Well, we have standing sets on the soundstage at Steiner Studios near Brooklyn Navy Yard.
So what do you got? You got the apartment there and you got the nightclub there?
Mm-hmm. We got B. Altman's, some of the interior
B.
Altman's there, the basement.
Uh-huh.
And, then they build sets for each individual. There's certain, permanent standing sets.
Yeah.
And then there's some, what they call swing sets, where they just, build them and tear them down. And
right.
So some of the Catskills stuff, we shot a lot of the Catskills on location, but some of the interiors, like the breakfast room and all that was done on the stage.
You shot on location in the Catskills, but you had to build one of those camps. They're not around anymore, right?
No. That was there. We found,
really?
They found a place. Yeah.
That's still there.
It's not, I don't know that we were actually in the Catskills. We were a little west of the Catskills in a town called Deposit, New York.
Uh-huh.
And at this resort that's really locked in time. I mean, it's
still functioning.
It's crazy. Yeah, it's beautiful. I mean, in fact, when they visited this location the year before we shot season two, they discovered they had old bowling alleys, so they wrote a bowling alley scene. They wrote the episodes to
around
the location.
The place, right.
Absolutely.
It became a character.
Absolutely right. And it suited, I mean, this is a place that is just so beautiful. And so it has never been, not to speak disparagingly of it, but it's never been upgraded or you know, kind of modernized. So it really feels like you're back there.
Really?
Uh-huh.
So you shot in France?
We shot in two episodes in Paris. So
have you been there a lot?
I had not spent that much time in Paris. I'd been to France a number of times, but we were there for 3 weeks, and it was heaven.
Yeah? Do you speak French?
No.
No.
That was the French, by the way. Not the English no. Very little, but enough to order the right wine and the right kind of, foie gras.
So. Yeah. So you're your character's not that far from you in that way.
Right. It was great. We were in Paris in March of last year.
Yeah.
And we had brought some of our crew with us, but and there were a lot of it was French, French crew too, and it was just an amazing experience.
And
they were into it. They loved the show from season one. And
they did.
Sure.
It's exciting, man. It's exciting to be part of an international phenomenon.
Well, I feel like I was very lucky, and I sort of stepped onto the right bus here. And
What was the audition process? Did they pick you? They knew they wanted you, or
they
how'd
called
that
me? I didn't read. They just asked me if I was interested, and I read the pilot. We only had the pilot to go on, and it wasn't much. There wasn't much of my character in the pilot. I mean, it was a few scenes, but they assured me that it was going to be expanded, and I love that period first of all, and I like the writing, and made me laugh, and so I figured, how bad could it be?
Yeah, I didn't know what was going to happen, like in terms of your character, because the weird thing about the show is that when you first start watching it, you think it's broad. You think the characters are broad.
Right.
And then, you realize it sort of sneaks up on you that they're not really. That there's a lot of depth and there's a lot of definition. And I imagine a lot of that you guys bring to the roles. But they're not, in the first few episodes, I was like, well, what are they going to do with Tony,
Yeah.
And in this season and half of the last season, you really have an emotional depth to the thing. You're not just, this presence.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it definitely, with all of us, I think, the complexity of the characters has expanded. And because her life, when her husband leaves her in the first episode of the first season, her life is impacted and there's all this upheaval, of course. But as it takes a while for... in the story to see the ripple effect of that upheaval.
Yeah.
The ripple effect to all the other characters.
Yeah.
Everyone's life changes in this story to a degree, especially the family.
Yeah.
And Joel's family, the Maisels, the people who run
Pollock,
the garment.
Kevin Pollock.
Oh my God.
And what's her name?
And Caroline Aaron.
Genius. Yeah.
So we see the ripple effect of this one action, and even the ripple effect to Joel, her husband, and how, and his regret and his kind of disconnection from what was his life.
Yeah.
And everyone sort of seems to be kind of landing, and he's not landing. He's just kind of floating out there, doesn't know what to do. is having a gigantic identity crisis.
Yeah.
So it's good. It's good. It's not just about this one character.
And also, like, the Jewish middle class of that time mm-hmm. is a very specific thing. You know, it's like, right, so that's like one generation from immigrants, most of them.
Sure.
And this is the first sort of, this is the first generation to kind of find their place. But you didn't grow up Jewish.
No. I grew up in a Lebanese American family. My father was an immigrant.
Yeah. Is there a similarity in the Semitic,
Oh, absolutely.
You know, I mean, so. you're of desert people.
Yeah, technically we're Semites.
Yeah,
so,
I know, right.
You know, it's really very close.
How'd you grow up? What was your religion?
Well, we were Catholic, I guess. I mean, you know, just sort of, we grew up in a, you know, we went to parochial school and all that.
Where was this?
In Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Yeah. So an unlikely place for an enclave of Lebanese people.
Right. I mean, was there a community?
Mostly they were my relatives.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was a smaller community of Lebanese.
How'd your old man end up there?
You know, I asked that question many times.
Yeah.
Never got a straight answer. You know, it was like all immigrants, you know, the people, whatever ethnicity they were of, you know, people came to New York or came to Boston or whatever, and or some of them went to South America, and, you know, they just kind of moved west because they were following wherever the work was. And when a certain area, a certain region, you know, the factories or whatever filled up, and then people had to keep moving, and somehow they ended up there. I don't know.
Do you know why he left Lebanon?
Oh, sure. He left because, it was right after the First World War. His parents had died there. He was the youngest of five. Four siblings,
yeah.
and they were, it was really, really tough times there, and the parents had passed away within a year or two of each other, and they were sent for by relatives already living here, because everybody, you had to be sponsored, of course.
You did.
But they came through Ellis Island. My dad, you know, they were orphans, and they came.
How old was he?
He was eight.
Oh, wow.
The oldest on the boat was only like 17. They came together. They didn't speak English. They didn't.
All five siblings came.
I believe the first one was already here because she had gone to school. She was the eldest, and she had gone to school in France, I guess. And so she had made her way here.
Mm-hmm.
But she couldn't have been maybe even 20. And, you know, but of the ones that were coming over on the boat, the oldest was, I think, 17 or 18, and my dad was eight. And they came on and landed at Ellis Island and took a train to the Midwest and were met by other relatives.
Huh.
And you know, what was really kind of heartbreaking was that the relatives that they met there in Wisconsin, well, no one family could have the wherewithal to take them all in.
Sure.
So they were kind of split up. Well, this one would go with this relative, and this one would go this one.
But in the neighborhood,
in the same community,
uh-huh.
but not in the same household.
Uh-huh.
So it was, and then they had to, you know, assimilate and learn English and all that, and it's while trying to hold on to their, you know, heritage too. So
yeah.
like the immigrant experience.
Yeah.
So.
Wow, Green Bay, and then it gets cold there.
And then my dad bought season tickets, and I still have them, and it's a happy ending.
Are you serious?
Oh, yes. I have eight, if you ever want to go.
Yeah, I mean, forever? You've had them since your father?
Well,
had them?
I had my, they were, yeah, passed down, and my father, I think, even had 16. But anyway, somehow I ended up with eight, and I try to go to at least a game or two, but when I can't go, other family members still live there.
You grew up with loving football?
Well, you had to. It was mandatory.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in the Lombardi years. You know, that was.
Oh, right.
It was
right.
It was like
the glory days.
It was like going to church. It was fantastic. Really?
Yeah. I'm not. I was never geared towards sports, and I think I missed something.
You never got that gene.
I did not. It has to be passed down to you, behaviorally.
Oh, absolutely.
By a parent or an uncle or a sibling.
Well, I think my dad. You know, he was a big guy. And he played football in high school.
Yeah.
So that was kind of part of
assimilating.
It was part of our thing.
Yeah.
And he was a he loved going to the games, and it was kind of a thing. Take his friends and his customers and his...
How many kids?
There were 10 of us.
That's crazy.
I was not number 9 of 10.
You were the 9th one?
Yeah.
So you have...
Second youngest.
You have siblings that are... How old?
Wow. My oldest sister, I think, just turned 79.
Wow.
She probably wouldn't want me to say that. Sorry, Sherry.
And you know all of them? You get along well? And
we all get together, you know, for a week in the summer. We have family reunions. We're all very... We still stay close, you know. I mean, we live in, some are still in Wisconsin, but I have two sisters in Atlanta and a sister in Sacramento.
Uh-huh.
We're all a brother in Denver. We're all over the place. But we stay close and try to, you know.
It's a lot.
I don't know, our kids, we try to keep them close. And
it's a lot, huh?
It's a handful.
I bet. So 10 kids. That's crazy. That's really Catholic.
It was bedlam. Yeah. Total pandemonium.
And how'd your old man support 10 kids?
Good thing about being in a family of 10 is you have a built-in audience.
Right.
Always.
Right.
You know, which is probably why I chose this.
Oh, yeah?
How did my dad do it? I don't know. You know, he was an independent businessman. He just figured it out. We were very middle class or lower middle class,
right,
I guess you'd say. But, we never really were, you know, it's not like we were wanting for too much.
What was the business?
He was a meat peddler. He sold sausage.
Yeah.
He bought from this little German sausage company in Sheboygan, which was about 40 miles away. And then he had a route and he built it up and he sold to stores and various places. And he built up his own business. And here's the cool part.
The meat business.
Well, yeah, meat. Yeah. And it was great. You know, it wasn't like commercially made. It was like the Oscar Mayer thing.
So he found this German sausage maker who...
There were a lot of them in Wisconsin.
Sure,
were doing the real thing. You know, they all got kind of, kind of crushed by the larger companies.
Right.
But at this period, you know, people were... And it was kind of... He believed in it. It was quality stuff. He was a really good salesman, I guess. And he just... Here was the cool part, though. I remember this when I was growing up. He worked 4 days a week.
Uh-huh.
He could have built it up and worked 6 days a week and made a lot more money and probably. But he had a lot of kids and he was a real, you know, he valued his time and his family and his other, the relatives and so forth. So he figured out a way to work just as many hours, worked hard.
Yeah.
But had, you know, those 3 days. It was great.
He knew what life was supposed to be.
Yeah, and he always told us too. He said, you know, he was a big proponent of, you know, being your own boss.
Yeah.
And not having to work, you know, for the man.
Right. And he always had sausage.
And we always ate, we had a lot of sausage. Yeah. We had it for breakfast. We need something, we just go out to the truck and open a box, boom.
Yeah. There. Was it other meats or just sausage?
It was like all different kinds. It was,
yeah.
And then they got into he opened a little shop that was like a mail order thing. It was kind of like candies, cheese, and sausage.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was kind of like one of those things.
So he had a cheese guy too.
It was Wisconsin.
Yeah,
so
I know, exactly.
It was everywhere.
Yeah.
You tripped over it in the street. But it was, he was a pretty cool guy.
And your mom, did she work?
She, she worked her ass off, but she was
right, 10 kids.
Mother of 10. And
yeah.
When I think about what she did, she was amazing. I mean, she was just running up and down stairs doing laundry line. You know, she kept it all together.
Yeah.
Imagine cooking for 12 people for that many years.
It's crazy.
Crazy. And she was really exhausted.
And then having to love them as well.
Yeah. She was loving. And she, you know, I remember these days when, I don't know how this woman did it. I mean, my wife and I, we had two kids and we had help and we couldn't figure it out. You know what I mean? We screwed up everything. But she made our, Halloween costumes and did our school projects. And I just can't even imagine it.
Yeah.
And plus that was in a day when, you know, there wasn't a lot of permanent press. Okay. Right. So, you know, she was ironing when she wasn't cooking and doing laundry and cleaning. She was ironing,
no help,
for God's sake. I mean,
I don't get it. It's crazy.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And
I think one of my early memories, I think I was like in first grade.
Yeah.
And we were, my homework was to, to like read aloud to my mother for, 15 minutes or whatever. And I remember I was sitting on the couch after dinner and I was, reading very, stilted thing and reading my book to her. And at one point I looked up and she was just fast asleep. She was sitting, sitting straight up with her glasses on.
Yeah.
Out. Yeah. And I thought, of course. I'm like number 9 for God's sake.
Man. Yeah.
Maybe she listened to my older siblings' books, but, and I didn't, I was like, wasn't upsetting. It was just like,
Yeah.
So makes sense. I jumped off the couch and went about my business. Let her sleep.
9. So she had the hang of it by the time you got there.
Well, she was over it.
Over it.
I think I got away with a lot of things my older siblings didn't.
What's the breakdown between men and boys and girls?
6 girls, 4 boys.
Wow.
Yeah.
And did anyone else end up in the entertainment industry?
Sure. I have a sister, an older sister, Susan, who's actually is on Stranger Things.
Oh.
She's Flo. She's the sheriff's,
Oh, yeah.
Secretary.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's great.
She's great. She's been a theater actor forever and done film and stuff. And now she lives in Atlanta. And I guess
you two,
it's somewhere in the blood.
Yeah. And just you two, though, in the show business?
Yeah. Well, others do. I have a couple other siblings that do it kind of, community theater stuff.
Right.
This and that, just to kind of, just for fun.
Anybody in the meat business?
No.
No.
No. Well, I'm in the meat business, aren't I? I'm a piece of meat.
Yeah. That you move around. Move the meat around.
Yeah.
How does it begin, though? Like, when do you start doing the acting? In high school? Were you a football guy? No.
I tried to be a football guy and I got my ass kicked. Yeah, I did a little in high school and, college, I guess.
Where'd you go to college?
I started University of Wisconsin in Green Bay, but then I transferred out to Portland, Maine. I went to the University of Maine in Portland, which happened to have a really good theater department.
But you didn't go for that?
No, I didn't know what I was doing when I moved.
Why'd
I was
you just, pick that school?
Because I needed to get out of Green Bay.
Yeah.
And I needed to have a little bit of a, change and shake up. And I was, when I first went to college, to be completely honest,
yeah,
I wasn't really pursuing anything. I was just kind of buying time and avoiding getting a job.
Right.
As many.
And what years were these, or were they, what was it, crazy times in the country? What year, like you're what, 10 years older than me?
I went to college in the 70s, early mid 70s. It was, Watergate was happening in the mid 70s.
Yeah.
And the war was trying to wind down. But I was, when I was a senior in high school and I was 18,
yeah,
we had to draft, lottery.
Yeah.
So that was still scary.
And what happened with you?
Well, my number wasn't really that high, frankly, but it was, this was 72.
Yeah.
And my number was, I think it was just around 100 or 110. It wasn't high.
Yeah.
But that year, because things were beginning to draw down.
And there was protests, right? I mean, it was.
Oh, yeah. That all started in the late 60s.
Yeah.
I think my year, they were only going up to 75, and my number was just over 100. So, but the year before, they were definitely into the 100, into mid-100s. So it was a little bit of a nail biter.
And none of your siblings had to go?
My older brother, Michael, was in Vietnam.
He was?
In the 60s. Oh, yeah. He's about 12 years older than me, so that would have been, I think he got drafted or he enlisted or whatever, but he was there. He was over there. Luckily, it was, he was right in Saigon, but it was before Saigon fell, so he was not seeing a lot of combat thing. But it was, my mother was just, she was a wreck during that whole couple of year period. Yeah.
And he fared all right?
He came home.
Yeah.
So we did all right.
Yeah. So you didn't have to go to war, so you went to Maine.
Which is kind of like going to war. No. Maine was fantastic.
It's pretty.
Portland was just so happening right then.
And you were just sort of biding your time?
But I was, then I discovered, they just, I did more theater and I just discovered that that was, you know, it might be my strong suit.
Were you like a long-haired guy? Were you doing experimental stuff?
A little fro.
Yeah, a Lebanese fro?
Yeah.
As opposed to the Jew fro?
A Leb fro.
A Leb fro. Yeah. You still got it.
Oh, please. Yeah, it was a lot thicker then.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, I just, no, we were doing, you know, whatever we could do. And the school, as I said, had a really good theater department. And so I was afforded a lot of opportunities.
Yeah.
And then I went to the Yale Drama School. From there, I was fortunate enough to get accepted to Yale.
Do you remember what you auditioned with?
Oh, sure.
Really? What was it?
We had to do two pieces of modern
and classic. Piece, yeah.
And one, they each were 2 minutes long, which is not long.
Yeah.
I did Malvolio from Twelfth Night, I remember.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a piece from a Pinter play called The Homecoming.
The Homecoming, yeah.
I did a Lenny monologue.
Oh, yeah, those are good. Nice and dark.
Dark.
Yeah.
Dark and yeah, funny and yeah. Twisted. So, but, you know, and then I got in, crazily enough.
Was that a two-year program?
Three-year master's program.
Yeah, I mean, I auditioned for it, but I was not in any way prepared.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, I didn't. It was all very last minute, and It was ridiculous.
Well, mine was ridiculous in the sense that it was the only school I auditioned for, which was stupid. You should audition for five or 10.
Was it because you like, if I get in there, it was meant to be?
No, and it was because I was stupid and didn't even know. I came into it almost by, it was just a fluke. I didn't know anything about it, but a friend of mine's girlfriend who graduated the year before us had gotten in there. She had graduated, you know, the year before us. And she had gotten in, and she told me, you know, this would be a really good place for you should try. I had no idea where Yale was. I didn't even know where New Haven was. I didn't know anything. I just was in a...
Wasn't that far from where you were at? You're lucky you weren't in Wisconsin.
No, I was. It was not that far. But I'm telling you, when I was a senior in college, I was in, even though I was doing plays, I was in a kind of a fog, in a deep fog. I don't know what... I can't even explain.
But you wanted to act. You liked acting.
I knew I wanted to act, but to be completely honest, Mark, I didn't know that there was such a thing as a graduate drama program. It wasn't on my radar.
Right.
Nothing was on my radar. My radar was a blank screen.
Were you lost?
I was just, I was an idiot.
Ah.
Yes, lost. Yeah. Lost idiot. And so had she not gone there and told me about it and encouraged me,
yeah,
I would have... You know, I don't know where.
Did it have the reputation it has now? I mean, I guess
sure.
It was.
Well,
it was...
Meryl Streep had just graduated, you know, 3-4 years before that. And so it was, yeah, I mean, it had a reputation. I didn't know what I was doing or what to expect.
What did you graduate college with? What was your degree in?
It was theater.
It was.
Yeah. But I didn't know what I was going to do. I mean, there were a few opportunities in Maine for professional or semi-professional theater, but I assumed, you know, what would I do? Teach or...
Right.
And
yeah.
End up working in a bar. Or
but did you, like, when you were acting in college, what did you feel like this, you were meant to do that? I mean, did you relish it? Did you?
I loved it, but yeah. I didn't believe or think that it was could be a viable career.
Right.
I just thought, well, this is fun and I probably would love to do this as a hobby.
Right.
For
that's
the
a reasonable thought to have.
Sure.
But the fact that you didn't prepare anything else is... You know what I mean? Like, you said, like, this can't be a job, but...
I had no plan B.
Yeah,
I had no plan A.
Yeah, right.
I had nothing. I was very, very lucky.
So you sat there and you auditioned for, what, three people, right?
Three or four people.
Yeah.
And then I left the room. And
yeah.
There were, you know, hundreds of kids, you know, waiting to...
No kidding.
Audition.
Uh-huh.
They'd audition people in New Haven. They auditioned people in three other cities.
And they take like nine?
Well, they took, Meyer, I think they took 15 or 16
uh-huh.
out of hundreds.
Yeah.
And now thousands that audition.
Really?
Oh, yeah, thousands.
That's crazy.
But then there was like 700, 800 that audition. And we had 16 in my class.
Yeah.
And then, but that was, you know, that was a place where we thought, you know, when we were going there, that would, we were going to have a life in the theater.
And
that was what it was geared to, not for... I mean, that, and then when I left Yale, I went to a regional theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
How much of what you learned there sort of defines how you approach the acting now? Or does it all just kind of...
No, I think it definitely informs it, because it was all about doing characters and doing things that weren't close to yourself.
Oh, yeah.
And transforming and, you know, trying to stretch. And my career has kind of been about doing characters. I guess so.
And the structure of it was like that was one of those schools where you had to, you know, do sword fighting and dancing and...
Oh, we had movement classes. We had stage combat. We had voice classes. Uh-huh. And we had, you know, scene study and text analysis. What we didn't have, thank Christ, was, you know, actual papers to write and tests to take.
Right.
We didn't have that. It was all, you know, conservatory. And it was the Yale Repertory Theater was there, so it was a conservatory situation. Students were being fed into professional productions at the Rep.
Yeah.
And that was, and some of those professionals were teachers at the school. And
so what was it? And then you started working shortly after, or were you working during school? Were you in the Yale Rep? Did you get in there?
I worked some at the Yale Rep. I mean, we were, you know, weren't exactly getting paid, but we were doing plays there. And then after Yale, I went to Cambridge and I worked in a regional theater, repertory theater.
ART?
That's right.
Yeah, and that place is, I lived in Boston for years. And I remember
if we were there at the same time.
Well, I was in college there from like, 81 to 87.
I was there 80 to 84.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if I saw any productions during that point, but then I went back and started my comedy career there in 87, 88. And, but I remember, who was there? Who's the guy from Mark, what was that show with Malky? You remember Braz?
Mark Lynn Baker.
Yeah, Mark Lynn Baker.
And Mark was there because Mark was a year ahead of me at Yale, and then a lot of us went up to ART. Mark's still a very dear friend and lives in New York.
I just remember him being in everything that when I seeing him there.
He was an amazing theater actor. And
so you were there for 3 years.
I was?
Yeah.
I was there for four seasons. Yeah.
At ART.
Oh, yeah.
Living in Cambridge. I lived in Somerville before it was cool.
I spent many, many
nights
lost in Somerville.
Yeah. You know where I worked? I worked at a place called, do you remember the shopping center, The Garage? It was in the coffee connection, where you'd go and you'd get the French press coffee.
Yeah, beautiful.
I worked there.
I remember The Garage.
Yeah, I was there. You probably came in and had coffee.
It was over by like St. Over by, what is that, Mount Auburn? Or
yeah, yeah, there were two entrances. There was one next to 40 Dunster Street.
Yes.
Yeah, and there was an entrance right there, and you could go in The Garage, which used to be a parking garage, and it was all the stores. But I was working at a coffee restaurant before Starbucks, and they'd serve, if you were going to have more than a cup to go, they'd serve it in a French press, very high-endy.
Oh, yeah.
You know, kind of, so.
Very, very ahead of its time. Yeah, because I did stuff at the Hasty Pudding, too, you know. When our new play festival was always there every year, so.
And were you doing mostly, traditional stuff, or did you do any, like, crazy shit?
We did a lot of crazy stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, we did everything. That was the beauty of ART. You know, we did some classics and reimagined classics, Shakespeare and Chekhov, of course. And but we also did, you know, Lee Brewer came up from New York. He was part of Mabu Mindset, so very, very avant-garde director.
Yeah.
And we had directors from England and from, you know, from Eastern Europe.
Uh-huh.
And so it was a real broad, kind of range of approaches and material.
And so you got to experience that. I mean, that's...
And I think that was really good because it didn't get locked into just one kind of school of thought or one way of working.
You know? Yeah.
All these different demands being made on us and you could, you know, you didn't have to be... We were members of a company, and so you didn't have to be afraid of making a fool of yourself. You were...
Right.
You know, you could really take risks.
Yeah, and that was your gig. You were a theater actor.
That was what my life was
for years.
That's what we were trained for. Even when I moved to New York, after Boston, I did pretty much nothing but theater for another 6 years. So it was like 10 solid years of doing theater. And once I was in New York, then I would do like a soap opera, you know, a day player on a soap, or I'd do an episode of such and such. And then I
was pre-procedural though.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Then I went into, do a little part in a movie here.
What was the first one of those?
The first one of those I was completely cut out of.
Yeah.
That was a fun story.
But you still got paid for it.
I did, but it was, It was Heartburn. It was Meryl Streep and Jack Nicholson, sure. directed by Mike Nichols,
yeah.
And I was had a great little part in it and then was completely cut out of it. But I don't really want to, you know, go too far down that rabbit hole.
Why?
Because it still hurts.
It does?
No. It was a learning experience, character building.
Uh-huh.
Then I did a quick change.
What was it like working with Nichols, though? I mean, did you have enough of a part to have a relationship with him on set?
Unbelievable.
Yeah?
And also, he brought me in to do, few years later, I can't remember the name of the film. It was with Travolta, the one about the kind of Clinton candidate.
Oh, yeah. What was that called?
Primary Colors, yeah.
And
I would do readings for Mike Nichols all the time. And
what makes a guy like that, you know, who had done theater and done these amazing movies and was one of those guys that really kind of defined himself in theater and then moved to film and made a mark on film in a very experimental way early on. So what was it about him as a director that was compelling and different than working with other directors?
Well, I think with Mike, you just knew that, first of all, he had all of this body of work behind him. And you have a guy with this mind. He was so intelligent, so sophisticated, so well read, so well, you know, traveled, so well, everything. And, you know, with Mike, you just always trusted that he has this amazing, gigantic overview of not of just what he's doing, but of the context in which that all sits.
Yeah.
And so you always got the sense that it was about more than just what it was about.
Right, right.
And that his agenda or his objective was much more far-reaching than just that piece of material.
So you trusted and respected.
Oh, my God. And he was funny
and
warm. So it was an honor to be, you know, in working with him the few times I did.
And
I never got to do a play with him, though. I always would have loved to have done that.
Do you prefer theater?
You know,
I mean, it's a weird question, but it's so immediate and it's so exciting in a way.
Yeah, I get asked that a lot. It's where I sort of started out.
Different job.
It's a different discipline and all of that. But the truth is that I base my, you know, my decisions and also what I like and on the material, not the venue.
Right.
Because I've been in bad plays, bad productions.
Sure.
And there's nothing more torturous than that. But you're stuck in it, you know. And that's been true of film and television where you're just in things and the fit is just not right. But you're, whereas if you're in a slot, you know, and you're feeling like you're in the right role, in the right material at the right time, it doesn't matter if it's TV or if you're just working on a street corner. It's all about that.
Right, but there is a difference because when you're working in film or TV, cut.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, I haven't done much theater, but I do stand-up, and now that I'm acting a bit, I realize that, you know, the trick of doing that type of acting is to really make the time on camera, you know, immersive, like how, you know, that you, there's so much time in between things.
Absolutely.
That it must be a whole other discipline to sort of realize, like, all right, I'm about to work for 2 minutes.
That's right. and when it's a very, you know, when it's an emotional scene or something where you really have to load up before you do it, it's tricky because, you know, they tell you we're going to do this scene in half an hour. And so you're gearing yourself up for that moment in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And then there's some delay.
Right,
and then
3 hours later.
Yeah, if you're lucky.
Yeah.
Or we're going to do this in an hour and then, oh, we change it. We're doing it right now. What?
Yeah, I
didn't really load up here.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're always at the mercy of the production. But if it's an emotional scene, you know, it's That's the challenging thing of movies and television, because they're all shot out of sequence.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, the worst story imaginable happened to me.
Yeah.
I was doing a film a number of years ago. It was The Siege with Denzel Washington. This is a movie about a terrorist attack in New York prior to 9/11. And I playing an FBI, a Lebanese-American FBI agent. And I'm Denzel's partner, and it's Ed Zwick is the director, and it's really heavy duty, great script and everything. Big Fox, 20th Century Fox movie.
Yeah.
The Annette Bening and everything. I was doing a movie just before that. I was doing Civil Action out in LA, and The Siege was going to shoot in New York. And I was supposed to have a break of about 2 or 3 weeks between movies. That almost never happens where I get back-to-back jobs, but
yeah,
this was a rare thing, and it happened. So I had this thing. It was all scheduled. We're going to finish Civil Action, and then 3 weeks later, I was going to go to New York and start on The Siege. Totally different character, totally different everything. Well, we got behind on Civil Action. It just, you know, we would lose a day and here and there, and then, oh my God, and we're behind a week. Now we're behind 2 weeks. And then it looked like I wasn't even going to finish by the time they needed me in New York.
Yeah.
It was really right down to the wire.
Yeah.
And they were almost going to have to recast me in The Siege and all that because of the schedule.
Ugh.
It was a nightmare. And then
anxiety on both levels.
And this production is freaking out, and this production is freaking out,
yeah,
and I'm freaking out. My agent's freaking out. So finally, they just, you know, a lot of back and forth between the producers, and they hammered it out. And I literally finished a scene on my last scene on Civil Action, 6 at night in LA. They drove me to the airport. I take the red eye to New York, and I start. Next night, I start The Siege, and my first scene, because of the scheduling jumble,
yeah,
my first scene is my big emotional scene in the movie, where I'm at this is kind of like an internment camp where all these Arabs have been rounded up, and it's martial law has been declared and all that stuff, and I'm looking for my son who's been rounded up and put in a pen, and it's the middle of winter, for Christ's sake, on Randolph Island or one of these places.
Yeah.
And it's like my big peak emotional scene of the movie. It's my first day, and I've just taken the red eye, you know, and Denzel's there, and there's army trucks, and there's thousands of extras, and I'm like, oh my crap, I haven't even met this kid. I haven't met the kid who plays my son, who's like a teenager.
You know, and what happened?
Well, I pulled it out of my
bag. I wish we could pull it up right now.
I wish I could.
So
I don't know. So, you have to watch the movie. I was in a, you know, because I thought, I'm going to, you know.
Well, you're frazzled, that's for sure.
I was frazzled, man. So that helped, I suppose.
But did you then have to, like, how much thought had you put into that character? I mean, did you have to sort of retrofit the character from that moment?
Well,
I
had to. I mean, literally on the plane to New York, I'm reading and trying to like, you know, make up some backstory for myself. And
yeah,
sure wish I'd met that actor who plays my son, who I'm so in love with, you know, who I have to, I'm dying to see and save.
Right. But you did.
So I'm walking through this set. The cameras are rolling. I'm screaming for my son. I'm screaming my son's name. I don't even know what this guy looks like.
No.
Oh, yeah. We hadn't even, you know.
You hadn't met him when you played it?
No, because I just arrived and it was like night and they're all in the thing. And
Denzel's got to be intimidating.
And Denzel, they've already been shooting for a couple of weeks.
Right.
So other stuff around me.
Yeah.
Because we're partners. I was in this movie for 3 months.
Oh, my God.
And he was great, though. He is a force, man. He is the hardest working, most kind of disciplined and really, really serious about his craft and, you know, and what he brings to it. So that was kind of an inspiration too, you know, just being at his side and then doing the scene. We'd only met. He and I had only met briefly.
Right.
And he brought it for me, you know.
Yeah.
Because I think he understood. I was on the hot seat. And anyway, that was, it's never been quite that bad.
Right.
That was the peak of bad.
So when you did Quick Change, was that like your second movie?
That was it was my second movie, but it was my first movie that I actually.
And that was a funny little part.
It was really fun.
The cab driver, right?
Yeah.
And then was that the thing that kind of broke you think? That got you visibility?
Yeah, I think in terms of film, sure. I mean, I was doing theater a lot in New York and
But TV too, right? I mean, didn't you pick up Wings after that? That put you on the map a little, that Quick Change did?
I don't know if that did or because I remember the producers of Wings who then also went on to do Frasier. Those guys used to come to New York a lot and they were real into theater.
Yeah.
And they were loved theater actors.
Yeah.
So I think maybe they had seen me in a play or something.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was Quick Change.
And Wings, like that, that's what made you move out here the first time?
I didn't, no, I moved out before I had Wings.
You did?
Yeah, I'd been in New York for about 6 years and I wanted to see what was LA was like. So I came out, I didn't have anything out here. I got that a number of months after I was here.
And that was a hell of a job. I mean,
that was a sweet gig.
I mean, that was for years, right? I mean,
you know, I was on it 6 years because I came into it late. You know, it had already been on for a year before I got into it because I came just to do one episode and then they wanted to bring me back.
I just remember there was a period on television where Wings reruns were everywhere. That like every station you were watching Wings somehow.
It was a really cool group of people. And, you know what was cool about Wings was I had never done sitcom before. I'd never done multicam.
Uh-huh.
I hadn't done that much TV, really.
Yeah.
And what was sweet about it was that we did it in front of a live audience.
Oh, yeah.
So all the theater that I had done and my background in theater, it was sort of came into play because we had immediate feedback. And so it was a, kind of a hybrid. And also, you know, I was newly married and our kids were young. And
where did you meet your wife?
I met my wife doing a play on Broadway. I was doing Heidi Chronicles.
Uh-huh.
And she came in to replace someone.
And
then it was all...
I remember her from movies, The Dead Zone. Like she's like
Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yeah.
Days of Heaven.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's great.
She's still going. And she's so great.
And you've been together a long time.
We've been together. We'll be married 27 years in April. So
that's great.
Amazing.
Yeah. So let's talk Barton Fink for a minute.
Okay.
Because like I talk to people about the Coens. That character is so fucking memorable. And that movie is literally one of my favorite movies, period.
That was maybe my second movie.
Right. But that character, was it Ben Geisler? With the stomach problem?
Geisler.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was that like? Because I think that for me, like a lot of people, Hail Caesar, which I thought was great.
Yeah.
Like that is a double feature, I think would be the greatest Hollywood double feature.
Oh, because it's all the studios.
Well, yeah, it's like the same, you know, it's literally the same world, but like quite different looks into
the tone. Yeah, the tone is
the wrestling picture. Now,
Wallace Beery, the wrestling picture. What do you need, a roadmap? Great words. Yeah, that's, I had seen, I didn't know them, but I had seen Blood Simple.
Uh-huh.
Whatever was right at, was it Raising Arizona?
Yeah, Raising Arizona, great.
Something, I don't know where that falls in the lineup, but I was mad for Blood Simple, and that was, and then when I got this call to come and audition for them, I was like, oh my God, I want this. I don't even have to read the script, I just want to do it.
Yeah.
And so I auditioned in New York, I was living in New York, and they were very receptive, but they said, hey, you know, listen, we're going out to LA to read people.
Yeah.
So we just, you know, I wasn't going to get an answer right away.
Right.
You know, I have to always wait, but
yeah.
I was really impatient with this one. And so they went out to LA and weeks passed, 3, maybe 4 weeks passed. And I just hoped that they didn't find another Ben Geisler out there. So they didn't. Then they came back and... I don't know, maybe I did a callback. I'm pretty sure I did a callback.
Uh-huh.
And then they went to LA. And then they gave it to me, and it was an unbelievable experience.
Yeah, why?
Well, I had never worked with two directors before, uh-huh. You know, in the same picture. But also just their writing.
Yeah.
I'm sure you can, you know, as an actor, you can sense it too. It's written in such a... rhythm. It really almost plays itself in a way.
Uh-huh.
You sort of step on the train and it carries you.
Wow.
And when I read this character for my audition, it just, I can't explain it, but somehow the mantle of this character or the voice of the character just came to me.
Uh-huh.
It was I read it as I sort of heard it in my head as a cross between Jackie Mason and Yogi Bear.
Right.
Remember Yogi Bear?
Yeah. Hey, Boo Boo.
And I thought, oh my God, it's almost like that's how they were. Of course, I've never had this conversation with them, and I'm sure they didn't intend that.
Yeah.
But that's how it struck me.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, I wonder if I could do Jackie Mason and Yogi Bear combined. And so I started playing with that, and then...
That was it.
That was Ben Geisler. It was just this crazy
thing. Have you gone out for any of their other movies?
Oh, I did. A number of years later, I did The Man Who Wasn't There.
Yeah.
That was a totally different character. I played a lawyer named Freddie Riedenschneider. You know, I didn't have to read for that one. They just want me for that one. But it's been a long time since I've worked for them, so.
Yeah.
I'd love to get back into that.
I worked with, Michael Lerner played my mother's husband on my show, on Marin, on IFC.
Oh my God.
For one episode.
Crazy man.
That's for sure. He's a real character, buddy.
He's a character. But I got to work with, John Turturro in Barton Fink, you know, and I didn't, you know, I had known John just a little bit. He was at Yale after me. So, but we came out of the same, you know, program and everything. So it was we had a blast. And an actor who just died, a few years ago, John Polito.
Oh yeah. He's great. Yeah.
Oh my God.
So funny.
One of the funniest, loveliest, best actors. And they used him a lot. I mean, they just kept pulling him into every movie.
Yeah. Big Lebowski.
And he also was in The Man Who Wasn't There. I actually asked him to come on when I was doing Monk. I asked him to come on and do, a part.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember the character's name, but he was like the hot dog king, you know, the guy who runs all the hot dog cart place.
Yeah.
And we walk into this thing to talk to him, and the place is filthy. People are picking up hot dogs off the floor and putting them in the water. I mean, it was really and he's always got one in his fist, you know. I could not look at him. It was so funny. But weirdly, I knew John way before that, because when I was at Yale, to pull this full circle, I was doing a production at the Rep of Measure for Measure. Chris Walken was in it, and that's the first time I met John Polito. He was playing Lucio or somebody.
Uh-huh.
Anyway.
And he was funny?
What a character.
Yeah.
What a lovely, crazy, funny guy.
Yeah. You were on Monk a long time.
I was 8 years, yeah, 8 seasons.
Do you find that that's the one that people identify you most with?
Yeah, it takes a while for, you know, that's what I like about Maisel too. It's just starting now to unravel that image of Monk. Just the way Monk unraveled the image of Antonio Scarpaggi from Wings.
Yeah, TV is weird like that.
It is. You find that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've just started doing it, but it's a different type of television. I mean, you know, when Wings was on, it was like, you know, almost everybody was watching it.
Well, there weren't 400.
That's outlets. Right. There was like three.
Yeah.
And then by the time Monk got on, there was a few more, but still not the same as now.
Yeah.
What was that on USA or
USA?
Yeah. And now it's just like, you know, free for all.
Yeah. Now it's a mile wide and an inch deep, as they say.
Yeah, but a dear friend of mine who I love and I work with sometimes, we do broadcasts together. Tom Sharpling wrote for
him. I love Tom.
It's great.
Oh my God.
So funny.
Really, what a mind.
Smart guy, yeah.
I think he probably, we did 8 seasons. Tom had to have been on 6 minimum.
Yeah, great guy. You ever really listen to his radio show?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. Him. He's so funny, man.
He's really got a...
We do these things called Mark and Tom shows. We've done 3 of them. We're about to do another where we just...
Oh, let me know when you do
I
that.
Will. We got one coming up, I think, in a couple of weeks. We had record... Like, when we have time, we'll just sit with mics, just me and him, and just talk like the two guys we are, you know, who live on the microphones. And it's usually fun for both of our fans. So when I saw you... When we did that roundtable together last year...
Oh, yeah, The Hollywood Reporter.
Yeah. You would just, I think you would just come back from the genealogy journey to Lebanon, right?
Well, I did that right after we shot Maisel in Paris.
Oh, so you were going? You hadn't gone yet?
I was going.
And what happened? So what drove you?
I was wanting to go to Lebanon, you know, for my entire life.
Yeah.
Because hearing and reading so much about it. But never had the opportunity, and when the opportunity did arise a couple of times, then something bad would happen over there, and it was impossible.
Right.
So we were going to Paris, and knowing we had a break right after Paris to before we had to continue Maisel, I asked my wife, I said, look, this would be a great time to go. We're halfway there. We're almost there. And we have time. So we set it up and we went for a week.
Wow.
In April, early April, when the weather was fantastic.
Uh-huh.
And we stayed in Beirut, but we would hire a car every day to take us to different, you know, it's not a very big country.
So
we would go in a different direction every day. But I got to see the village where my dad was born and even the house where he grew up.
Really?
It was incredible.
How did you get that information?
It was not easy. It went through a number of different channels, you know, with people we were traveling with, knew this woman who's a lawyer, and then she made a call to this other person, and then they got in town with the little mayor of this little village, and then, you know, mentioned my name, and, you know, would it be possible for him to see the thing? And it was amazing. We met with these people in the village, and then they walked us over to the house.
Yeah.
The man who now owns the house just happened, he doesn't even live there, he just lives in Montreal or something, but he happens to visit there a month a year, and so he let us in. It was open arms.
Oh,
it was incredibly moving. I mean, the garden was, the almond trees are there and the grapevines. And oh my God, I was trying to, photograph and video everything I could.
Yeah.
And I was able to get a lot. And I don't speak Arabic, so we always had to have a translator with us.
And did you have people there? Do you have relatives?
I didn't find relatives there this time. I wasn't really looking for relatives, to be honest, because we had a limited amount of time. I was really focusing on just seeing as much of the country as I could and the village. And then I thought, if I go back, then I'll get into the whole. Because that's a whole time-consuming thing. You can't just...
Oh, to track relatives?
I think it really is.
And
I would want to spend time. And anyway, our time was limited, so... We accomplished what we could. We saw a lot of the country, and it's just an extraordinary place.
Did you feel connected?
Very much, very much so.
Hmm.
And
was your mom Lebanese?
My mom was, well, yes. She, her father was Lebanese, and her mother was, I think, from Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that was, sort of her mother's, her family, my mother's family, was from the same village that my father was from. So they all, it was all.
What village? Tight.
It's a little village called Abla, and it's on the edge of a larger city called Zahle.
Mm.
And this is an area where, I don't know if you know this, but Omar Sharif was actually Lebanese. His name, his real name, is the same as mine. Same last name.
Saloub?
Uh-huh. Yeah. And thought he was Egyptian because he grew up in Egypt.
Yeah.
But he's really, I think his father was from this clan.
Uh-huh.
And so his family also was from this same area.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's a little movie trick.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Possibly we're even related in some
you think so?
Strange fashion. Well, I was at the Golden Globes.
Did you fix the gap in your teeth?
Yeah, I did. But I tell you, if I showed you pictures of my dad when he was young.
And Omar Sharif?
Oh, my God.
Didn't crazy. He have a gap in his teeth, or am I not remembering correctly?
Oh, yes, he did. Very amazing. So, but at the Golden Globes last week, I ran into his grandson, Omar, who I had met last year at the Globes.
He's in show business?
And he must be, because he's at the Golden Globes.
Yeah, right.
But he's really a fine looking young man.
Oh, yeah.
I took a picture with him and everything. And he always said, my grandfather thought that we were related. He's,
you're going to have to track it, man. You're going to have to do it someday.
I am going to track it. And I'm really sorry I never got to meet Omar Sharif. But.
Yeah, but that's interesting. I can't, it must be like a complete mind-blowing thing to have your history in that defined a place or that unique a place.
Yes.
And then just to go see it for the first time, it must be mind-blowing.
It was. It was incredibly emotional, and you can't even take it all in. There's just so much going on there, so much to it, so complicated. The politics and the economy and the and everything that's going on in the region. You know, it's
but you must look around and think, like, I look like these folks.
Yeah.
Like,
I absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, there's my cousin so-and-so.
Exactly. Because, like, as a Jew, even though there's a Semitic connection, I mean, I don't know how many generations I'd have to go to get back to the desert. I mean, for me to do what you did, I got to go to Poland and Russia.
Yeah.
And I've often thought about it, but I don't know. Poland doesn't seem that hospitable. Russia seems interesting to me, but I don't know if it's a great time to go. But maybe I'm wrong.
Well, you know, really in Lebanon, that's always been an issue. When is a good time to go?
Yeah.
Because everything right now, or when I was there 8 months ago, you know, it was in a relative period of calm, but everyone there is thinking, well, when's the other shoe going to drop?
And right.
When is the next crisis going to hit?
Well, now the whole world's thinking like that. We're doing that here now.
I'm doing that. I'm doing that in Los Angeles.
Yeah, every day. What's going to fucking happen next? Oh, but you did go. That's good for you.
Yeah, I'm glad I did it. And I really would like to go back.
Well, you will. It's great talking to you, Tony.
Oh, Mark, I could talk to you forever. Thanks.
And congrats on the show. It's really a sweet show.
And on yours.
Thank you.
Wonderfully done.
Thank you. What a great conversation. What genuinely a nice guy. As I said before, the second season of The Marvelous Miss Maisel is now streaming on Amazon Prime. Go watch it. You can also go to podswag.com/WTF or the merch page at WTFpod.com. There's new signed posters, there's t-shirts, there's signed books, and later this week, there's going to be some copies of my last special, Too Real, on vinyl. I'm gonna play a song for, I'm going to just make something up. Just riff a thing for Buster. Ugh, fuck. Okay. Live.